I'll be reading from Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28. We should be grateful that we were given a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And in this kingdom, we please God by worshiping Him and by showing Him great honor and respect.
Good morning. For the life of me, I don't know how to introduce this lesson, and time is running real short for me, huh? Y'all are supposed to laugh. I can't help but to think, as we study through the second half of the book of Daniel, my mind keeps drawing back to a good correlation between the preaching of Daniel is actually the book of Hebrews. And I think it was Ron Burke that mentioned 1 Samuel chapter 8 the other day. Israel, they wanted to have a king because they wanted to be like the nations. They wanted to have the protection of a king like the nations. And, you know, interestingly enough, sometimes the very thing that you want ends up destroying you. You ever had that problem before? Well, Israel went through a whole succession of kings until they just spun down to nothing and ended up in Babylonian captivity. Hence, this is when the book of Daniel gets written, right? They've tried everything they know in an earthly, worldly way. Now God, in a really interesting thing, God pulls out a crystal ball and says, I'm going to show you what's going to happen in the future. Now, have you ever seen these people on TV and movies look in a crystal ball and be able to tell what's going to happen in the future? If you knew what was going to happen in the future, you'd be at the dog track a little more, wouldn't you? You'd be at the Isle Casino a bit, wouldn't you? I mean, that would actually have some influence on you. Hey, I know what's coming. God comes to His people in the last half of the book of Daniel and says, look in my crystal ball. Here's what's going to happen. That's not only going to influence His people, it's actually going to influence some worldly people too. And when you look in that crystal ball, you know what you see? You see the kingdoms of the earth falling down. The very thing that we saw in Daniel chapter 2 with the great statue, the head of gold, the arms and the breast of silver, the belly and the thighs of bronze, and the feet of iron and clay, and the rock that was cut out of the mountain without human hands, the Christ, how it smashes the statue and knocks it down, and how the kingdom of Christ gets set up. I want to tell you something, church. I don't think that we fully appreciate the kingdom to which we're in today. We come here every week. We visit with each other. We study a little bit about God's Word. But do we understand that it's the blood of the saints that stain the foundations of the church? Do we understand that the Lord gave His blood in the very inauguration of it? Do we take it for granted? I don't know about you, but I do. I get complacent in my thinking. Now, I want you to run a what if with me, okay? What if the government said, Cedarloo Church, you can't worship God anymore? What if the government said, Cedarloo Church, you can't sing any more hymns to God? Cedarloo Church, you better not be praying. Oh, by the way, Cedarloo Church, we're going to set up a statue of Buddha in the front of your auditorium. And when you come to church on Sunday, we want you to worship Buddha. What if that happened? I know what you're thinking. Preacher, your much study is making you crazy. But I want to tell you something. It did happen in the past. And it will happen again. And a little bit of preparedness is what God expects from His people, okay? So with that in mind, maybe I better check my notes and see where I'm at. The precious kingdom that so many of us easily take for granted, it came at a great cost. And that's what I said a while ago. When we, and I want to mention this, I don't get too big a hurry here. The first six chapters of Daniel was written in Aramaic. And the last six chapters is written in Hebrew. I don't know what to tell you that means, but I bring it up for a significant... I had an idea of what I thought it meant, and I asked Sam, and Sam said the very same thing I thought. Check out the audience. Who's the intended audience for the first six chapters? Who's the intended audience of the last six chapters? Although there's applications for God's people in the first six chapters, the message is resounding to Babylon. But folks, when we're in these last six chapters, the message is the kingdom people. And the message is about the kingdom. And I got to tell you what, I'm excited to be in the kingdom. And I hope you are too. I hope that's what Daniel motivates you to do. We begin, now the writing of Daniel, and we're in Daniel chapter 8 for today, and the writing is beginning in the reign of Belshazzar, so the Babylonian kingdom is not quite over, but it's almost over. We've done a whole lot of talking in the first part of the book about the book of Daniel. Last week in chapter 7, we looked at the four beasts that come up out of the sea, and we really focused in on the last beast, the fourth beast, which was Rome and all of its emperors, including the little horn of Domitian. Who does that leave for us to talk about? The two middle kingdoms, the Medo-Persians and the Greeks. That's where we're going in chapter 8. Now, I've titled chapter 8. I've given it a title. And the title's meant to challenge you, okay? I'm not going to tell you what the title means. It has meaning, and I want you to search for it. The title of the message is 2300 Days of Hell on Earth. Okay? There's your title. So if you don't get it during the sermon, that'll be my problem. But come see me afterwards and we'll work on that. Let's start Daniel chapter 8 in verse 1. I've got to stick a little closer to my notes because some of this is kind of complicated. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. You almost have a little bit of heartfelt feeling for Daniel. He probably doesn't want to go to sleep. Some of these dreams are disturbing, you know, and quite alarming to him. But he goes to sleep again and he has another dream. Israel's still in Babylonian captivity at this time. And Daniel's last dream had alarmed him, made his face pale. And now, in this vision, when you read the last verse of Daniel chapter 8, you understand that Daniel finds himself sick and exhausted. And you know what? I just don't want to run off and leave that point too quick. Sometimes the Lord's work is exhausting. If you haven't felt that, maybe you haven't been working. Because when you're involved and you're working in the kingdom, let me tell you what, sometimes you just get pooped. Anybody in here ever get spiritually pooped? Are you too pooped to raise your hand? Yeah. Sometimes it gets that way. And you know what? That's how Daniel finds himself at the end of this vision. In a very short period of time, Babylon will fall. In chapter 7, God told his people what that fourth beast was going to be, and today we're going to see the second and the third beast described more fully. So let's dive into that, Daniel chapter 8, verses 2 through 4. I looked in the vision, and while I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the You know, I've got priorities each week, and pronouncing words is not always at the top of my list. Eulial canal. Then I lifted my eyes and I looked, and behold, a ram, which had two horns, was standing in the front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram budding westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased, and he magnified himself. This is a vision. The word vision is used in the text. It's described as prophecy. It points to the future. It is of God, and it will come true. Point number one. How's that? Here, Daniel's vision puts him in the citadel of Susa. Your version says, the Hebrew says Shusha, which is in modern-day Iran at the north end of the Persian Gulf. It is also the center of the Medo-Persian Empire, okay? So Daniel is having a vision. He finds himself in the citadel of Susa beside the word canal is the word river, and he sees in his vision a ram. Now, I had to look up what a ram was because I got a faint idea, but I don't have a full understanding. A ram is a male sheep. There you go. Looks like a big, fluffy, furry thing with big old horns curled on the front of it. So that's what a ram is. He looks up, and he sees a ram. And the ram is beside this river. And the interesting thing about this ram is, the ram had two horns. One was longer than the other, but the other was coming up last. So it had two horns. It had one that was bigger, but the bigger one actually came up last. Said, I saw the ram. It was budding. I looked that up in the Hebrew, and it's an aggressive word. It's a word of aggression. That's what this ram's doing. This ram is going to the specific direction, south, west, and north, because of its location. I'll explain that in just a minute. But it's budding. It's aggressing the things around it. No other beast could stand before him. Because why? Because he'd take them out. No one could have a presence of power or authority before this ram. This ram would knock them to kingdom come. That's the idea of what's being said. And not only that, if you were captured by this ram, there was nobody to rescue you from this ram. So you get an idea that the ram was all-powerful and in control of whatever was going on around him. But he did as he pleased. If you look in the Hebrew, that's talking about he does his will. Now, in the church, we understand any time the word will is brought up, we think about God ultimately because it's him and his will that directs our lives. The ram is only concerned about his own will. And do you check out the last few words there? The ram magnified himself. Now, I just want to give you a quick note, a kingdom note. If you magnify yourself, you got a front row seat to God's wrath. How's that? If we don't learn anything today, we better get a hold of that point because you're going to see that point more than one time. Now, I want to tell you what this means from the interpretation given at the end of this chapter. So I'm going to do a little blending, okay? You'll have to follow up, kind of like last week. You have to go read the end of the chapter to catch hold of what I'm saying. I'll give you a little location, though. Verse 20 tells us that the ram, which you saw with two horns, represents the kings of Media and Persia. So the text tells us that this ram who had two horns or two strengths of power were the Medes and the Persians. Now, interestingly enough, I didn't know this when I was preaching last week, and I may have misstated something, but it's real minor and we're fixing to iron it out. Persia was the big, known to be dominant bunch under Cyrus the Great. But Persia wasn't always great. As a matter of fact, the Medes were more dominant than the Persians at first under Xerxes. You've heard of King Xerxes and all that business and how... So, the little horn was Persia at first. And then the little horn grew up to be the big horn later under Cyrus the Great. You see what I'm saying? Now, we talked about this last week when we saw the bear lifted up on one side. Same image, different view. Okay? Now we have a ram, and it has two horns. The large horn is Persia, the Persian kingdom, but it didn't come up first. The first mighty horn was the Medes, is a part of that. The ram was budding northward, westward, and southward. I already mentioned that, about how aggressive they were, and they were that indeed. Let's look at verses 5 through 8. Verses 5 through 8 says, "While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came up to the ram, and he had two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and he rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram, and he shattered his two horns. And the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly." Do we have a magnification disease going on? At least in this text, do you think we have any magnification problems in our current world today? Possibly so. "As soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven." One of the versions, I think it's King James, instead of male goat, uses the word he-goat. You call it whatever you want as long as it's a male goat, right? It's a he-goat, whatever it is. So here you've got this ram at the beginning of the story that finds himself all-powerful, but along comes a male goat. And the male goat comes from the west. Now, you need to know something about biblical geography, okay? If we say north, south, east, and west, you understand that all comes from one spot on this planet, right? The North Pole. That's where you make determinate is mapping. Isn't that right? Take your compass at all points for the magnetic. Well, biblically speaking, geography has a center like that, and the center is Palestine. When you're reading, particularly the Old Testament, and you read something north, south, east, or west is talking about from Palestine. Now, when you find out who this is in a minute, you'll understand they came from the west, okay, because you'll understand their location. But this goat was going so fast, the Scripture says, that it did not even touch the ground. Interesting note, and the horn, this male goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. Something that really stood out that was notable to people. The male goat came up to the ram in fury, in wrath. He attacked the ram, knocked the two horns off the ram, trampled the ram to the ground. No one could rescue the ram from the male goat. That's the vision that Daniel's seeing. Verse 21 says, hey, church, here's what I'm talking about. Here's what this means. The shaggy goat, or the male goat, represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, I want to point something out to you. I want to take a break from my notes for just a minute. I want to tell you something. You can turn on TV today, and you can listen to all these theologians or proposed theologians that try to make this stuff everything except what the book says it is. Are you with me? Now, I'm telling you, Christians can buy into that garbage too. God said, here's what it is. He did it last week. But we get half the free world saying, there's four beasts coming and they're going to be the nuclear this and all. No, that's not what God said. This week God says, hey look, we got a ram and we got a goat, and here's what they are. The Medo-Persian Empire and the Grecian Empire. Here's what they are. So there's no mistaking about that, okay? Now, where was I? History records that Greece's first king was Alexander the Great. And just with a little bit of effort, you can understand how great and fast that guy was at conquering the world. Hence the goat, the male goat, going across the surface of the planet, going so fast that he's not even having to touch the ground. You see the imagery. And how he conquered the Medes and the Persians, and how there was great wrath between them. Okay. Interesting little note. The male goat with the horn, Alexander the Great, he came to Jerusalem to destroy Jerusalem. Now I'm fixing to tell you something that's really cool, so start smiling. Gene's smiling. He gets to Jerusalem and he's going to destroy Jerusalem. And you know what? One of the priests says, Alexander the Great, follow me. Come into the temple. Look at the book of Daniel. God said you were coming. Alexander says, let me see that. Well, by doggies he did. I'm special. God said I was going to conquer the world. Look at me. I'm not going to destroy you, Jerusalem. Interesting note, isn't it? I don't know how it fits, but I thought I'd tell you about it. He fancied himself the almighty work of God, which is probably the beginning of his downfall. You remember the text saying that he magnified himself? Church, heads up. When you magnify yourself, you're at the altar of God's wrath. Okay? And that's what Alexander did. Magnified himself exceedingly, the text says. We've been doing crossword puzzles lately at home. We've learned to really pay attention to words. Not just the fact that he's magnifying himself, but he's doing it exceedingly. Over and above and beyond what we can think, ask, and imagine. You know that type of stuff? Way out there. This guy really thinks he's something. God's going to show him he ain't nothing. So when he had exalted himself greatly, at the age of 33 years old, he dies of a drunken fever. He had conquered the world and died in disgrace. I know another 33-year-old man that conquered the world and died in honor. Jesus the Christ, and his kingdom endures forever in church. That's where Daniel's leading us in our thinking. Okay? The male goat's horn is now broken off. But four more horns grew up in its place. So the male goat its big horn, Alexander the Great, broken off. He just died. Four more horns now come up out of that. You ever chop down a tree? Think, man, I'm glad I'm rid of that sucker. Next spring, it's already grown another tree this tall. You ever seen that? All those suckers that come up? Well, there's four more suckers going to come up out of the root of Alexander the Great. Let's let God make that proclamation to you from verse 22. The four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms that will arise from this nation, although not with his power. God says, here's what it is. That's the interpretation God says. So with that knowledge, we just simply look at history and say, what was it? How did it work? The kingdom that Alexander had fought so hard to gain was now being pillaged from within. 13 men fought for the empire of Greece. When the dust had settled, four men took control of the kingdom. Hence, four horns coming up out of the spot where the one was broken off. You may recognize some of this. There are four Grecian generals fighting for power. First one is General Cassander, who ends up taking Macedonia and Greece. Horn number two is General Lysimachus, who took Thrace and Cappadocia. Horn number three is General Ptolemy, heard of him, who took Egypt. And the fourth general was another general you heard of, General Seleucus, or Seleucus, or however you pronounce that, that took Syria and Babylon. You've heard of the great infighting that goes on between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, right? You've heard of all that. The text tells us that these four horns, these four new divisions of the Greece Empire, they were toward the four winds of heaven. Possible meanings there could vary, but I kind of thought that they had their mind set against God, and I think you see that played out in the way that they run their kingdoms. And if you want to understand a little bit more about how they run their kingdoms, I have a lot of history books in my office you can check out on that subject. In chapter 7, we saw the smallest horn becoming the biggest pain in the backside, right? One of these horns is the Seleucid Empire, right, which is the Babylonian-Assyrian division of this new kingdom. This one horn, it gets a little horn that grows out of it. And when God says, oh, here's a little horn, you know, my human thinking, I think, little, insignificant. I thought that in chapter 7 until I saw the little dude being Domitian that so persecuted the Lord's church, and I understood that was God's view of the horn, little, insignificance. That's his view. Me as a person here on earth, I'm going, whoop, better watch out for that dude. Right here, the fourth horn that comes up in the place of Alexander the Great has a little splinter horn off of him. And guess what? Well, we're going to talk quite a bit about this little horn. Let's read verses 9 through 12. Out of one of them came a fourth, a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land, or glorious land, depending on your version. It grew up to the host and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of hosts. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground, and it will perform its will, and it will prosper. If you read history, you know who the fourth horn is. The fourth horn, some of you may have heard of, is a really bad dude. named Antiochus the Fourth, who took on also the name Epiphanes, so we invariably end up referring to him as Antiochus Epiphanes. This is this horn that comes up out of the fourth horn. Antiochus Epiphanes came about as the result of transgression, as noted in the text. Sin is what gave him the pass to do what he did in the world. And you know what? That's going to be a real key note for us as Christians to understand that sin opens the door on things sometimes that you can't close the door on. It's kind of like Pandora's box. Once you've opened it, you have a hard time closing the crazy thing. And you know what? We take sin so lightly sometimes. Don't we do that sometimes? Isn't it easy to think this really has it'll make no big difference in the world if I do this? Antiochus Epiphanes comes on the scene because of transgression. He starts his reign in this way. He robs temples in Persia. He overruns Egypt. And hearing about the revolt that's now at the time of this vision going on, and when you look at Antiochus Epiphanes, you're talking about the year 170-ish to 164-ish A.D. You're talking about the Jewish Maccabean Revolt. You're talking about Jews in Jerusalem saying, you know what, you're not going to be installing our high priest. You're not going to tell us how to worship God. We're revolting against you. And you know what? Antiochus Epiphanes says, I'll tell you what you're going to do, Jerusalem, because I'm in charge over you. That's what he tells them. Antiochus Epiphanes, starting in 170-ish, I got to say ish, because some of the years is a little bit unclear, starting about 170-ish, starts persecuting the Jews in Jerusalem greatly, heavily, and mightily. He comes to the Jews in Jerusalem and says, you will no longer worship God in this place. Disperse from this auditorium. Be gone from God's temple. God will not be worshipped here. Sound familiar? You don't speak of Him. You have nothing to do with Him. Oh, and by the way, boys, bring in the pig. We're going to offer a pig on the altar of God. It happened. Go read about it. 1 and 2 Maccabees and the book of Josephus. Go read about it. So God's house was desecrated by sin. Not to mention taking a pig and offering that upon the altar of God, how sacrilegious that is and how sacrilege it is to tell God's people that they can't have anything to do with Him. When he got done, he set up a statue of Jupiter in the temple of God to be worshipped. Sound like my introductory story? Oh my. He cruelly kills anyone that upholds the law of God. But just as the text says, flip back and read that. The regular sacrifice is ended. I think about that and I think how drastic it would be for us today if our worship services were just ended. What if we couldn't come back next week and be with each other? I think about sometimes how flippantly I get ready for church. Oh, I got church here in a little bit. But you know, there's a different way to think about that. Oh, I got church in a little bit. I'm going to get to go be with my fellow saints and worship God in joyfully harmony. We can unite our voices and lift the sacrifices of our lips up to God and praise and worship. I'm excited! And I'm thinking, I got a little bit of a headache. Do we get complacent, church? I think we do. And I'm thinking about this kind of as we're going here, and I think Antichus Epiphanes kind of woke us up there, and all of that got removed. Now, let me read you, as a result of Antichus Epiphanes and the text we just read, truth was flung to the ground. Did you catch that in the text? As a result of sin, truth gets trampled on in God's holy place. Do we ever stop to consider that sin in our lives causes God's holy place to be trampled? Well, if you're like me, I just play it off. Well, it's small. God's grace will cover it. God's grace abounds. You know, we do that. I don't have the... it's not on my priority list. You know what I'm saying? I'll get to that next week. I'll do better in the future. The interpretation of that section given by God, incidentally given by Gabriel from God, here's what Gabriel says this means. In the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. His power will be mighty, but not by his own. He will destroy to an extraordinary degree, prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and holy people, and through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence, and he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease, and he will even oppose the prince of princes, and he will be broken without human agency. Interesting thing about Antichus Epiphanes, he died suddenly of a disease in 164 B.C. Not by human hands, not by human agency. Every jot and tittle of what God is saying came true. Every single piece without exception. And to all this, Daniel finds himself getting sick. But there's another crowd of onlookers that are not getting sick. You got the host of heaven saying, we want to know more about this. And you know, when heaven surrounds the Lord and says, tell us more about this, it makes me just that much more fascinated. Verses 13 through 14 says, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will revision about the regular sacrifice apply? While the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled. He said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. Did you catch my title? 2,300 days of hell on earth. You want to know what hell is? Hell is separation from God. You figure it however you want to. Hell is separation from God. For 2,300 days, the regular sacrifice, the ability to worship God, will be removed. Now, that's what Gabriel says. Here's what it is. This is what this is talking about. This is what it is. But you know what the world does? The world says, oh no, that means this. And I'm going to give you one of them. If you're offended, I'm sorry. I'm just going to say it. If you're listening on the internet, I'm sorry, but it's the truth. The truth hurts. Swallow it and move on. The Seventh-day Adventists look at the 2300 days and they say this is 2300 years, which puts us at the date 1844, and that's when the Lord is going to come back. So when 1844 came and the Lord didn't come back, the Seventh-day Adventist Church said, uh-oh, we made a mistake. Oh, we know 1844 is the starting of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We just started in 18. What? Okay, now the Seventh-day Adventists, I love you and I hope you get this figured out, but just read the text. The text says 2300 days in concern about when the regular sacrifice will be restored. Other groups of people, I won't mention them all, make it 23,000 years and this is a... Hey, just read the text. I did the math, and I'm no rocket science, but I can tell you this, it's 6 1/3 years. The Hebrew text is very specific. It says, if you look at your text, mornings and evenings. This is not symbolic, and you're not going to go read days of 1,000 years to the Lord and totally get out there in context. This Hebrew word, very specific. It means the start of a day, the end of a day, a 24-hour period of time is allotted by man. 2,300 of them, 6 1/3-ish years. Now, interestingly, guess how long Antiochus Epiphanes had his little reign of terror and how long the church was denied of its ability to worship God. I want you to just guess. Jay, what'd you say?
6 1/3.
Yeah, you got to say ish because you can't. You have a little problem. That, how long? 6 1/3 years. That's what he was saying, right? Anybody else want to venture a guess? 6 1/3. Hey, when a man makes a prophecy that something's going to happen and it doesn't come true, what happens? He's exposed as an imposter, right? He's shown that God has nothing to do with him. Daniel writes down the vision as related to God, and it happens like clockwork. History is not giving credibility to the Word of God here. God's Word gives credibility to history. Do you see this? History just comes alongside the truth as spoken of before it happened. Now, part of what I need to say here, I got to finish up. God's people are going to go through some hard time. The end of captivity, they're fixing to be released and go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple and all that. 400 years. Not a peep from God. Well, is God with us? Has He abandoned us? Has He left us? Is the Medo-Persians crushing us and God doesn't understand what's happening? Is Alexander the Great at our front door thinking about knocking us down and God doesn't know what's going on? Is God out of control? Here's Rome. Rome is squashing us. Domitian is killing some of us. Nero's lighting some of us on fire to use his human candles. Does God not know what's happening? Church, let me tell you something. God knows what's happening in your life. God knows what's happening in His kingdom. And His kingdom didn't come to us lightly. His kingdom come to us over the backs of a lot of Christians who have had to contend earnestly for the faith to the point of death. And then we get up on Sunday morning and say, oh, I've got a little touch of the sniff. I'm going to stay home. Or I've got a ball game. I'm going to go to a ball game. The Lord will understand. How dare we trample the very foundations that's been laid by so many faithful Christians. How dare we disglorify God by not understanding that we are a part of an eternal kingdom, a kingdom that will not fall, A kingdom that cannot be broken. A kingdom that glorifies God with every thought and with every action. Gabriel says in verse 19, sorry for being a little long, "Behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end." I've got to address this real quick. I can't leave you hanging. The time of the end. The second coming of Christ. Here goes the whole theological world. And I tell you this, read the context. What are we talking about? The Medo-Persian and the Greek Empire. The end of what? The end of the Medo-Persian Greek Empire. If you try to make this about some future something, well, then we start sticking in nuclear missiles and all this stuff. The whole book of Daniel is pointing to the kingdom of Christ coming, right? If you interpret that to be something outside of that, well, over here in the year 20, what is this, 2010? Yeah, I forgot what year it was. Here we are in the year 2010. Well, you know, this is going to be Russian, this is going to be... You're missing the point. Daniel is told, listen to this, this pertains to things in the future. Seal up the dream. Don't tell it. Now, does that strike a chord? That ought to strike a chord with you. Because John in the book of Revelation says, hey, unseal this dude, the time's at hand. You see, Daniel's over here saying, the kingdom's coming, Christ is coming, he's going to set this great and wonderful kingdom up, and John's over here in the book of Revelation, woohoo, it's here. Isn't that pretty cool? Church, it's here with us. Put some smiles on your face because we're here worshiping God because we're in His kingdom. We're kingdom servants. Isn't that cool? Let's not forget God's in control. Let's not forget that God knows what's happening in our lives. And God will work His purpose. You want to know the purpose of God? I don't know how many people I've heard wrestle with this. I don't know what God wants me to do. Whether He wants me to change jobs or whether... You fill in the blank. Does God want me to move here, marry this person? Fill in the blank. Let me tell you what. Forget all that junk. What God wants you to do is to glorify Him through His will and His purpose, and that's connected to only one thing. The salvation of man's souls. God don't care where you live. God don't care what you eat. God don't, and I'm telling you, read the book. God cares about the souls of mankind. That's what His kingdom's about. Let's not lose focus of that. Let's rededicate our thinking toward God's plan and purpose in His eternal kingdom. If you have a need in that way, if you have something that God needs to address in your life toward His kingdom purposes, maybe you haven't been yielding to the kingdom. Maybe you've been a kingdom service incognito. Nobody really knows that's what you are. Maybe you're hiding out. Whatever your need is this morning, would you come as we stand and sing?